Good morning. So last time we talked about ways that processors let us manipulate bits. We had one operation we started with, which was right shift. We mentioned, well, you know, sometimes you want to get some bits from the middle of a number. In hardware, that's really easy because, well, the bits are typically on separate pieces of hardware and we can just ignore the lower ones. But it doesn't quite work with registers where we have a whole register. We want to ignore the lower part of a register. We have to do something to it. And an operation the processor could provide was break shift. And we saw that there actually were two different versions of this, and that depended on what we did with the bits of the register that were kind of added, because we shifted away some bits and we had to replace the upper bits that we were adding effectively. And one option was we could add zeros. Another option is we could add copies of the sign bit. And both of these were useful because they're kind of equivalent to division by zero, depending on whether you think a thing is signed or unsigned. We also saw the opposite operation, left shift. That's moving value bits in the register to the left, from least to more significant places. And that's equivalent to multiplying by a power of 2, just like adding zeros in base 10 is equivalent to multiplying by a power of 10. So that was moving bits around. We also wanted to do things to particular bits. And we had this idea of bitwise operators. So we had in hardware these operations that were performed on usually a pair of bits that were easy for the hardware to provide. And the bitwise operators basically, we can give two numbers and it performs them on every pair between the two numbers. And the way we can think of this is that we can say one of the numbers is a mask. And we can read the bits of that number as selecting certain bits to do something with, like selecting certain bits to keep and other bits to clear. And the bitwise operations apply that mask. So bitwise AND applies a mask that says to clear certain bits and keep certain bits. Bitwise OR applies a mask which says to set certain bits and keep certain bits unchanged. Bitwise XOR applies a mask which says to flip certain bits and keep certain bits unchanged. Then we looked through some examples of doing more complicated things with bitwise operators. We started working through, and we'll finish today, example of doing the ternary operator. So you've seen, so this X question mark colon Y, sorry, Y colon Z, which is the same as if X, Y, L, C, and that's a syntax you can use in Java and C++ and C, which you may or may not have seen. And we mentioned sort of two things that we can do to help solve this. And one was this trick that we can divide it into these subproblems, that we can say, first, let's worry about getting Y when we need Y. So we'll have something which is Y or 0. And then let's worry about getting Z when we need Z, so something that's Z or 0. And we can combine these by just ORing them together. We could also add them together. And it's going to be simpler to get Y if X is true and otherwise 0 than it is to get Y if X is true and otherwise Z. So that's a simpler problem for us to solve. We can sort of build up our solution from that. And we are also simplifying things by starting with worrying about how it would work with one bit and then building up two more bits. And that's where we finished off last time. So questions about things we talked about last time before we continue today? Okay, so we were working on our ternary operator, and we said we're going to divide and conquer. We're going to have these two versions. We're going to get the Y or 0 or 0 or Z, depending on X. We mentioned the Y or 0. Well, if everything's one bit, the way we can do that is we can just say, oh, I can just write out all the possibilities, and that looks like bitwise, that looks like the AND operation. We only have the last bit we're worried about, so we'll just do a bitwise AND. Bitwise AND is going to compute ANDs for every pair of bits, but we only care about the last one. And I can say if that's how it works for getting Y, Z is just the opposite case. We just treat X as if it's the opposite of what it is, so I just take the complement of X to flip that bit that we care about in X, and take the opposite of that, and we had this solution. So we're solving this sort of by dividing it into the getting y part and the getting z part, and we make sure that when we don't get y, we get 0, so we can just combine these two parts. We don't get z, we get 0. And we can see sort of an example of how this works. So if x is 1, y is 0, and z is 1, this should return 0 from y. And we can see sort of how that evaluates. So this is just what we finished up with, but I think a little hastily last time. And one thing to note is that this doesn't work if, you know, this had this constraint that we assumed x, y, and z were all 0 or 1. If they aren't, it doesn't work. So, like, if I do x equals 1, y equals 4, z equals 2, you know, this is not, we should say x is true, so we should return 4. And that's not what's going to happen if we actually evaluate it. And that is because, well, we weren't looking at what happened to anything but the least significant bit. And we needed to fix that. And so we started saying, okay, so let's fix that. So we're changing our constraint to x or y is 0 or 1. So x is 0 or 1. But sort of y and z can be anything. And we're still going to do the same subproblems, but now we're going to have to solve these subproblems for y and z being bigger numbers, so we have to worry about more than the bottommost bit. So I can't use that approach I started with earlier, where I said, I'm just going to make a truth table and check which operator it matches against. And sort of a strategy we can think of for this is that I can think of this problem, this first subproblem here, which is that I want to get y sometimes and 0 other times, as I want to select some of the bits of y, and the AND operation will do that. So I want to have this mask that selects some of the bits of y, and what bits do I want to set? Well, if x equals 1, I want to keep all of the bits of y. And if x equals 0, I want to keep none of the bits of y. And a cute trick we can use here that maybe you might think, wait a moment, this maybe isn't so easy in hardware, but a trick that at least works as far as writing expressions in like C is that this is just minus x, because minus 1 happens to be represented with all ones. There are other ways we could do this too, like just showing. So questions about why. So this, I should write out the solution. So this will give us y anded with minus x. So questions about why that would work. Okay, and then we want to do the same thing for the other subproblem, where we want to get z sometimes, but it's the opposite case. When x equals 0, we want to do, we're doing z ended with the mask. We want the mask to be all ones. When x equals 1, we want the mask to be all zeros. So a way I can do this is I can say, well, I know how to solve this when x is flipped between 0 and 1, so I can replace x by something which just flips between 0 and 1, and one way I can do that is XORing x with 1. Another way I could do that would be like, you know, 1 minus x. But I just am using the solution I had before, just adjusting x first to account for our little change and when we want which mask. And so this gives us a solution of z ended with minus x XORed with 1. questions on how I got that subpart. Yes. So this is question is Z and minus X. And X is. How do we come to this solution? So I'm using, so before we had this solution, Y ended with minus X. And an observation I can make is that this is the same problem, except I want to swap X being 0 and 1. So I just used the same solution, except I substituted something which is 0 when the old X was 1, and 1 when the old X was 0. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah. So the question is, how can I apply this to if I have, so let's say my problem is if x equals 0, I want to get some value, otherwise I want to get another value. So I guess let's go to our sort of full solution, right? So I combine the two parts, and this is solving this if x Y, L, C. So you wanted to do like something equals 0, so like if W equals 0. So in order to solve this, we just need some way of turning W equals 0 into a 0 or 1. And now we can use this solution. And we're actually going to get to that issue later. So because we still have this constraint that X is 0 or 1, but we can work with that. And so, and just to make sure we go through this full solution, so we just combine the two subparts into one big expression here. Okay. Questions? Yeah?
How do we know that just combining them with an OR won't mess anything up?
How do we know that combining with an OR won't mess anything up? We constructed our subparts, so when we didn't care about the Y or the Z, we got a 0. And ORing anything with 0 always gives the same thing. A way we can know this is that when we talked about what OR means as far as masks go, if we have a 0 in the mask, it says leave it unchanged. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we still have this constraint here that X is 0 or 1. And let's talk about, can we get rid of that? So what's the easy way of doing this in C? So if we're writing C code, the easy way of doing this is to use the bang operator. Because exclamation point X is 1 if X is 0 and 0 otherwise, and we can double exclamation point X does that again. So we get 0 or 1, where we get 0 if X was originally 0, and 1 otherwise. And you might say, okay, well, how does that work? And typically, this gets compiled to actually just do like a test instruction to set the condition codes and look at the 0 flag, which certainly makes sense because we have a 0 flag, you should take advantage of it. But maybe it's not so satisfying if we're thinking of, you know, what sort of is a hardware strategy for actually doing this operation. But if we take advantage of that, we can have this solution here. So basically, I just took my previous solution, and I said, well, now I want to deal with X not being 0 or 1. So I'm going to use the bang operator to normalize it to 0 or 1, because I know that's how it works. But this might be unsatisfying as far as bit manipulation, because we're using a pretty complicated piece of hardware, like the comparison machinery, to do this. Is there something that's maybe like closer to what the hardware would actually do? Okay. So questions about this solution here before we go into resolving, what if we don't have this nice convenient bang operator? How could we do that with sort of simpler bit manipulation? Okay, so next example, we're gonna look at our problem of seeing if any bit of X is set, which is exactly what that double exclamation point does. We want to turn 0 into 0, non-zero into 1. And I mentioned EZC solution was bang, and many of you solved the bang problem in the lab, so you know a way of doing it with addition or subtraction. But that's also pretty complicated. Like, addition's not a simple thing to implement in hardware. So we're gonna show a solution that works with something that's more manipulating individual bits, which might be closer to how you would actually do this kind of operation in hardware. And we're gonna see how we could do that in something like C, using the sort of instructions the hardware provides us for manipulating bits. And for thinking about this, we're gonna apply our common strategy we've seen before of try to solve a simpler subproblem. And the subproblem I'm gonna start with is, let's say X is smaller. So let's say X is 4 bits. Or I can start with the simplest version, which is, let's say X is 1 bit, our solution is X. And let's say, we can do small amounts of X. So if X is 4 bits, a way we can think about this is, well, I have 4 bits, I can just deal with them individually. So I'm gonna extract the first bit, and then I'm gonna extract the second bit, the third bit, and the fourth bit, and I want to get a 1 if any of them are set. A way I can do that is I can bitwise OR all the bits together, because that's gonna say I'm gonna set that bit to 1 if any of them are set. And that would give me a solution like this. So what I'm doing here is, first I'm extracting the least significant bit, then I'm extracting the second least significant bit by shifting the whole number over 1 and just taking the bottom bit, the third least significant bit, and the fourth least significant bit, bitwise ORing them all together to get 0 or 1. So questions about how this solution works? Okay. So this works. If we extend this to like a 64-bit number or a 32-bit number, you might say that's not gonna be very nice in assembly or C. Can we do better? And well, the answer is yes. And a way we can observe how we can do better is we can look at what's happening here and we can find out that we're doing a bunch of redundant work. And we can get rid of some of that redundant work. And there's sort of two forms of redundant work. We're gonna start with the simplest one, which is that bitwise operators have this distributive property. That here, I'm bitwise ending with 1 a bunch of times, which just keeps the lowest bit and zeros on all the other ones. It doesn't matter if I do that first or last. The end result is gonna be, I'm gonna have whatever I would have otherwise in the lowest bit and zeros in the other bits. So I can simplify this by just doing the bitwise end with 1 at the end. Yes, this means that in the middle, we're gonna have junk in the other bits, but it doesn't matter because we're clearing them all at the end, rather than clearing them earlier or proactively. So questions about this distributive property? Yeah?
So why does the distributive property work?
Why does the distributive property work? So look, there's multiple ways we could prove it. And this is not a math class, so I'm not gonna do it formally. The intuition I would use is that bitwise ending with something is keeping only that bit. And it doesn't matter if we're doing this, earlier or later, we're still gonna end up with that bit the same as it would be otherwise, and the other bit 0. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so there's some more redundant work we're doing, and that's gonna be a little less obvious. So if we look at our operation here, this bitwise OR here does, assuming our numbers are 4 bits, 4 OR operations, because that's how bitwise OR works. It ORs every pair of bits. And it turns out we're only using the bottom one, right? All the other bitwise OR operations are just stuff we're having the hardware do we don't care about. And a way we can make this more efficient is we can say, well, we have these other bitwise ORs that are going to happen anyways. Could we get some useful work out of them? And the answer in this case is yes. And in particular, in this case, we actually don't need to look very hard to figure out how we could get something useful out of here, for example. And to see that, let's observe what's happening in our first bitwise OR operation. So we're taking x and x shifted over 1, and I've just represented the bits. I'm going to represent the bits of x as x3, x2, x1, and x0. So these are our two numbers we're bitwise ORing together, and here's our result. And I've highlighted two parts of the result because our final answer we actually want is all the bits ORed together. And it turns out we have the top two bits ORed together already. That just happens to be a thing we're doing just by accident. And that's a sure useful thing to have. So we actually have two useful values we computed in this one bitwise OR operation. We've computed the bottom two bits ORed together and the top two bits ORed together. And that would help us save a step, because previously, in our original expression here, we had this other bitwise OR we were doing primarily to get those top two bits ORed together. And turns out we don't actually need to do that, because we're already doing it in this first operation. So how can we take advantage of having both parts? Well, what we want to do is we want to just align these two things to be in the same bits so we can OR them together to get our final results. And a way we can do that is we take our value, which I'm calling y here, we get from the first bitwise OR, shift it over 2 to align those two values, bitwise OR, and now we have our final result in the lowest bit. And we saved a bitwise OR operation. Questions about this sort of how this idea is working? Okay, so that can give us a final solution of something like this. We're doing those two steps to get R as any bit set value. Okay. Questions? And I can generalize this further. So we have we can do this with more than just once. We can have this sort of whole big tree that we bitwise OR pairs of values together. Because if I have 8 bits and I do this, I have not just two bits that are useful for me. I have 1, 2, 3, 4 bits that are useful to me. And then I can combine pairs of those, and I can save a whole bunch of OR operations because each of my bitwise ORs is now doing a lot more work that I care about. Yes, I still have some values being computed, like say this one, that I'm not going to actually end up using, but I've made things a lot more efficient because I'm using more of them. Maybe in bigger problems I could figure out how to use all the bits or something like that, just not here. Some questions about sort of how this generalizes. So you can see here, like, our next step is that we're going to do z shifted over 4 to get our final answer. But if it was ORing that, we'd see. And so the general form of this, we're doing, say, 32 bits, is we just do this whole tree to get our final results. Questions about this sort of divide and conquer idea, this sort of tree bitwise operations? Okay, I was definitely expecting more because usually this is the topic people have problems with. Guess we're okay. So let's do some. Oh, I guess I should mention generally, just as a review of bitwise things, for the homeworks, things to know, things I recommend. You know, a big strategy we used is finding subproblems, like how does it work with fewer bits? How do I, you know, or divide it into pieces that I can combine, especially with that trick of if I get, you know, I have a conditional, get a result or zero. And I can easily combine that with something else that gets a result or zero. Remember this idea of, you know, we can extract particular bits with this mask and shift pattern. This comes up, this is probably the most common thing that comes up when we're using bitwise operations in like real programs, is we want to get particular bits. So we mask to extract those bits and shift to get them into typically the least significant part of our result. Note that we can do, you know, that we have these sort of distributive property, especially for bitwise AND. And also look for cases where we're computing values twice. So, for example, I wrote out this earlier on, and if we're talking about like not doing too many operations, well, I don't need to compute bang x twice. And generally, like for the homework, don't feel like you have to put everything on like one or two lines. That's definitely not required. Even though I know some students like trying to do that. Okay, so we've done bitwise operation. Let's do a few exercises. So here, I have a goal of swapping the least significant and second least significant bits of x. So my question is, which of these will do that? I'll give you a minute or two or three to figure it out. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what's going on. And sort of a way I like figuring this out is I wrote out sort of the bits sort of symbolically. Usually the way I would figure this sort of thing out is I would say, okay, what happens to this bit? So for example, if I take, you know, a binary number, which is UVWXYZ, and AND it with 1, I'm going to get a bunch of zeros and a Z. That's usually how I like figuring out what's going on with this sort of problem. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, a couple people. Okay, give a little bit more time. Okay, so who thinks A's will do this? B, C, D? Okay, we have pretty good consensus, which is often not what happens when I give this exercise. Okay, and as I said, the way I figured it out is I sort of wrote out the bit patterns and what happens. So like we can find out that A, if I look at our first part, we extract the second least significant bit and put it in the bottom place, which looks very promising. This other part here, we extract all but the second least significant bit, we OR those together, or we just duplicate the second least significant bit, basically. In version B, we end up getting the second least significant bit in the right place, but then we extract the top, move the bits over and extract the top part, probably meant to use a different mask here. And so when we OR these together, we're gonna get U, V ORed with U, W ORed with V. We're gonna change all the bits other than the second least significant bit by ORing the pairs together, which is not what we wanted. Let's do figure out version C, and version D was very close, except we didn't XOR at the end without clearing the bottom bits. So we ended up changing the bottom bits to be XOR the bottom two bits with each other. So questions on any part of this exercise? Okay, so let's talk about our second topic for today. I guess I should mention that if you're on the homework, you can like write something verbose. You don't have to fit everything in one line. So, like, what's a better way of writing this? Okay, so our second topic for today is going to be about instruction sets. And there are a lot of instruction sets out there, instruction set architectures. So we have x86 and ARM, probably the most common ones, but there's a whole bunch of others that are in various levels of usage. And we're gonna talk about what instruction sets are, but there's a whole lot of these. So we have, and these are ones that are actually made today, like there's even more that are entirely historical. So, you know, we're gonna talk about, so what's different between these, you know, and how is having a different instruction set than just a different processor design? And when we talk about instruction sets, we're gonna talk about sort of two concepts. So we have instruction set is the interface visible by software. So when we talk about an x86 processor, we talk about it can run software that's expecting to run an x86. This is separate from the microarchitecture, which is the actual design of the hardware. So for example, Intel and AMD have multiple generations of chips that implement essentially the same instruction set, the same software interface. You can take a version of Windows that runs on one and it will run on the other, generally without any changes. And for any instruction set, there's lots of ways of implementing it. And for microarchitectures, well, there's some places where I just improve the design to make it, you know, better. But there's also differences you might make, for example, if you're implementing something with low power or for like a desktop, right? You might have different design choices you make in your microarchitecture, even though you're implementing the same instruction sets. But those differences wouldn't be visible to the software from a perspective of what instructions do. You know, we could run the same software on both machine, both our low power processor and our high power desktop processor, and it should work the same, even though, you know, the processor might be built in a rather different way to optimize for that environment. So we're talking instruction set is the interface visible to software. So which of these would be instruction set changes? A little time to read over and think about them. We have a bunch of possible changes. Asking which of them should we consider and change the instruction set. If we like went from one processor to another in this change, where would we say the instruction set changed? See if you and your neighbor agree. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A would be an instruction set change? Okay, couple hands. How thinks B would be an instruction set change? Okay, pretty much no one. Who thinks C would be an instruction set change? Couple hands. Who thinks D would be an instruction set change? So we have good consensus that D would be one. Who thinks E would be an instruction set change? So you have good consensus that E would be one. Okay. So D and E, I agree, would be instruction set changes. Let's talk about the others. So a test I would use for is it the same instruction set is that if two things are the same instruction set, I should be able to take anything that runs on one and run it on the other and vice versa. So if we're thinking about that, A is an instruction set change. If I have a program written to use these extra registers and they don't exist on some other thing, it's not the same instruction set. It can't run the same program. And also, C would not be the same because software compatibility is not just I reassemble and recompile. It's the literal same bytes. And also, it includes things that like write machine code, right? So for ISA, like we shouldn't need to change our compilers, our assemblers, or anything like, or our operating systems, or anything like that, you know, if it's really the same software interface. So we might have two ISAs that are similar, but You know, they're different ISAs. If we have any change to what the software can see about sort of how instructions work, we will not call B, changing how fast things run. That's not something we're going to call part of the ISA. Even though, yeah, that's going to be something which changes, but we are going to call any change where it's just going to make it so I can't take a program in one machine and just run it on the other unchanged, including like compilers and so on. So questions about what we count as a part of the instruction set? Yes? Is C part or not part? C is part of the instruction set.
Okay.
Yes. So instruction set compatibility. Yeah, so by software compatibility, I mean we should be able to use like the exact same compiler. And everything should still work. Other questions? Okay. So I guess a note I should make about what instruction sets are. So I'm telling you, like, adding or removing instructions changes the instruction set. And you might be saying, some of you who are familiar with things about processors might have said, wait, you told me that x86 and ARM were instruction sets. And I know that x86 and ARM have been adding new instructions. What's going on here? The way I would describe this is that there's a sort of a base x86 instruction set. There's a bunch of variants which are different instruction sets. Usually, they're set up such that they're forwards compatible. But I would say when you add a new instruction, that's a different instruction set. So there's a whole bunch of different variants of x86 that have been made over the years as they've expanded things and added extensions. And you might say, okay, so that's what new processors are doing. They're using a new instruction set. And, well, yes, they often add some new instructions when they make a new processor, but usually that is not the primary purpose of a new processor design. Usually the primary improvements are in things that are part of the microarchitecture and not the instruction set. Things that affect performance, but don't change what software has to do. So you can run the, because the one of the goals that processor manufacturers typically have is that you take a new processor and it runs your existing programs better. And if your existing that means that the way it's running them better can't be anything about a slightly more expansive instruction set supported by the new processor. Because the old program's not going to use that. Okay. And we're going to mostly ignore like little changes to instruction sets. We're going to talk about sort of the high-level goals when designing instruction sets. So someone tell me, what's something that, if I'm designing a new instruction set for some reason, what are some goals I might have, things I'd be trying to do when I do that? So we're going to talk about, like, here's what we're talking about, big overall things I want to do. Yeah. Okay, so you want it to be Turing complete. I want it to be able to compute anything. Okay? Other goals I might have. Yeah? So, manipulate memory, anything more specific, or?
Access and write memory.
Okay. So you want to be able to access memory. Do we have... So these are sort of functionality check marks, but a bunch of things we do in the instruction set are kind of more about convenience. So what are things that we should have in our instruction set design to make things more convenient or maybe more efficient? One of those two. Those are often our considerations. Yeah. Okay, so human readable, like assembly. So a goal we might have is human-readable assembly. That might be a goal we have in designing an instruction set. Okay, other goals we might have? Okay, so supporting, so good support for basic math. So basic math. So it's worth noting that Turing complete means we could do the math, but what we actually care about is that it's convenient to do the math, right? We don't want to say, the way you're going to add numbers is you're going to do a bitwise XOR and a shift and an AND. Even though you can add numbers in that kind of way, we want to say, there's an AND operation. Yeah. And other arithmetic you might want to do, like multiply. Maybe you want something to help with that. So some other goals you might have. Yeah. Speed and efficiency. So that it can be implemented efficiently. That's commonly going to be a goal. Other goals we might have? So we'll see sort of a bunch of other examples later. So another question might be sort of whether we have specialized operations, sort of might be sort of ease for compilers. So we talked about human readable assembly, but maybe our actual goal is to make it easier for compilers to use it. That's our goal. So, and we'll look at some examples a bit. So we have a whole bunch of instruction sets out there. And we have these bunch of goals. You know, we have particular operations we want to support. We might have an efficient implementation we have in mind, you know, that we want to support. We might want to support sort of making it easy to understand if people are going to be programming by hand. Let's look at sort of a high-level view of things instruction sets do, and we'll look at some particular decisions that might have an impact in one way or the other. So here's sort of a high-level view of a bunch of instruction sets. We have x86-64. We have our textbook subset of x86-64 called yd664 that we're going to be using, and a whole bunch of others. And I've listed the length of instructions, the number of what I call normal registers. So this is registers like RAX, RBX, RCX, and so on. Because there are some other registers. So for example, in x86, there's like floating point registers. I'm not counting those. And the approximate number of instructions. So counting instructions is a little tricky. For example, x86 has an add instruction that adds a constant to a register, and an add instruction that adds a register to a register. Are those the same instruction? Are those not? Depends who you ask. That's why it's approximate number of instructions. But you can see we have lots of variation pretty much all the columns here. So we have big variation in how many instructions there are. So x86 has 1500-ish, which is a lot. And a bunch of other instruction sets are that way. And some instruction sets are very small, so like Itanium and Z80 and MIPS or RISC-V are pretty small. Z80 really small. We also have a big variation in the number of normal registers. Maybe not so big, but so like x86 and R have about 16, and you have some with like 30, and then you have these platforms which have only a few. And you have the very special case Itanium, which has 128. And we also have instruction length. And there are a big difference we can see here is that in machine code, this is the machine code instruction length, that some platforms have variable length instructions. So x86, the machine code for an instruction depends on the instruction. So some instructions are simpler in machine code, some are more complicated. Some other platforms, the instructions are just a fixed size. That's a big decision to make. So these are a bunch of high-level decisions which are made. And let's say, so how do these decisions relate to our goals earlier. So one example would be the number of normal registers. If we're talking about being efficient, well, if we're not accessing memory all the time, that's more efficient. So that might be a reason to have more registers. But, you know, programs can only actually effectively use so many registers, so maybe we don't have too many. And that's sort of a consideration that goes into how many registers do we have. Like if we have, you know, almost no registers, then we're going to access memory all the time, that's slow. If we have lots of registers, we have a question of can people writing assembly or compilers actually make good use of that? And also, implementing lots of registers is probably going to be hard, like in the hardware, to do efficiently. For instruction length, if we have a fixed length instruction, that's a lot easier to deal with in the hardware. But if we don't have variable length instructions, then this means that we're going to have this awkward problem of if I want to like put an 8-byte number in instructions, that's pretty hard if my instructions are 4 bytes. I have to do something to work around that. And so those are examples of kind of where we've seen those trade-offs. And I guess the number of instructions is another one, because if we have tons of instructions, that's a lot more convenient for writing assembly. You have instructions for lots of things. It's a lot harder for making the hardware efficient. We have to implement all those instructions. Other questions about sort of our trade-offs that we can see here? So there are some other big differences in instruction set design that you might take for granted because most of you have just seen x86. So one of them is condition codes. So in x86, we learned about condition codes, that we have this sort of compare is separate from the conditional jump instructions. A lot of architectures have chosen not to do this. They have chosen instead to have a separate instruction that does a comparison and a jump in the same instruction. That's a choice, and you can argue one of these is more or less convenient than the other, but that's a very common difference in instruction sets. Another choice we've seen from x86 is that x86 has made a particular choice to make it convenient to access memory computing addresses in a particular way. And generally, there's lots of variation in how you can specify operands. So in x86, we can specify these memory operands that do this little computation that's like an array access. And other platforms have their own sort of unique variations on that. So for example, ARM lets you specify an operand which does a bit shift as part of making the operand, just like in x86, you can do a memory access as part of making the operand in that computation. You can do a bit shift as part of an operand in ARM. That's a decision they made. They think that's going to be convenient, just like x86 said, oh, it's convenient to do array access computations. So ARM made that decision. VAX has a way of doing pointer dereferencing in the middle of an operand. So you can specify your operand as a pointer to a pointer, basically. And it will take care of that. And so these are things where maybe we're supporting slightly more complicated operands, but we're making some types of assembly, you know, easier, more efficient to write, assuming that these features are used often enough. Questions? Ways of specifying operands? And I should give a vocabulary term here. So I call these addressing modes, so that's usually the name we use for different ways of specifying operands, is addressing modes. Because most commonly we refer to accessing memory, though this also refers to things like our ARM example where we're like specifying an operand that's a register shifted rather than just a register. It's a different addressing mode. Another big choice instruction sets make is how many operands. So in x86, they've decided that they're going to generally have 2 operands. And a lot of other architectures have decided to have 3, where you have a source, and a destination. And, well, the advantage of our first one is that we avoid a bunch of move instructions. The disadvantage is now we have to put more things in our machine code. We have to specify three things in every instruction instead of two. And VAX, in its infinite wisdom, chose to support both. They just have both versions of most instructions. So questions about choices with operand support? Okay. So we have a bunch of these different design decisions we've seen. And there's sort of one sort of big goal. So we talked about overall goals. There's one big sort of set of goals that have changed over time that reflects what instruction sets look like. And this came out about the time that like MIPS was being made, and has probably been the most sort of influential thing in instruction set design, which is an idea called the reduced instruction set computer. And this is basically a philosophy for designing instruction sets. And it's kind of reflected in architecture today. We'll talk about kind of. But textbook talks about this concept. You might say, so what does this mean? What does it mean to have a reduced instruction set computer? Well, it's reduced from the complex instruction set computer. But what does that mean? And I think to understand what's going on here, it's worth knowing what happened at the heyday of the complex instruction set computer design philosophy. So this old instruction set design philosophy that's not what we do anymore. And probably the best example of that was VAX. And VAX was taking our suggested instruction set design goal of human-readable assembly really far. So here are some real VAX instructions. And something to think about is, how do you implement these in hardware? How do you implement these in software? These are real instructions that VAX supported, like in assembly. So at the top, we have find string in string as an instruction. And the string can have an arbitrary length. The thing string you're finding in can have an arbitrary length. We have evaluate a polynomial of an arbitrary size. And we have basically printf, or format, as instructions. And these are things that should seem weird today. You'd expect these to be library functions, not instructions. Why would these be in the hardware? And how would these be in the hardware? If I asked you to write these functions, write these as functions in C or Python, they wouldn't be trivial. They're pretty complicated. They're a lot more complicated than any instruction you've seen in x86, probably. And you might say, how is this implemented? Do we have to do string and string? Do we have like a loop in the hardware? And the answer is kind of. The typical implementation of these involve what are called micro-instructions. So basically, the hardware design that was common at the time would translate the machine code to other simpler machine code and run that simpler machine code. And that simpler machine code could have like loops to implement instructions like this. So all our instructions were actually translated to some other instructions. So this is what was happening in the hardware, is that this was really was translated to other instructions. That was the common implementation technique. And something people said is, well, is it really worth having all this sort of complex micro-instructions someone had to write when we could just generate simpler instructions ourselves? And also, there's multiple ways of doing this. Did they really put the right one in the micro-instructions or not? And the answer was sometimes yes, sometimes no. And so an observation was, with these complex instructions, that even though we were providing an instruction that did find string and string, It usually wasn't faster than just doing that by yourself because it turned into the same sort of simpler operations. And it was a lot of work to implement in hardware all these instructions. And there was a big shift that probably was the biggest motivation for it, which was that compilers were replacing handwritten assembly. So the VAX instruction set was clearly designed with ease of writing assembly in mind. And these days, that's usually not a big goal because, well, a compiler is going to write the assembly. So we don't really care about making it easy for humans to write assembly. And so when people were designing RISC, they had probably two assumptions, one of which was right and one of which was wrong. The assumption they had, which was right, is that no one's going to write assembly by hand anymore. And at the time, this was a big assumption, but it basically turned out to be true, that very rarely do you write assembly by hand. The assumption they had, which maybe was less true, is that they assumed that, oh, we can just recompile things all the time. And that's turned out not to be an assumption that's worked out. People do not like recompiling programs all the time. You still get programs as precompiled things. Like, you can't, like, recompile it because you have a new processor. But sort of the RISC idea was, rather than trying to have the hardware implement these complex instructions well, let's have the compiler implement those operations well using simpler instructions, which is what the hardware is really doing anyways. And the goal of the instruction set then is to expose what the hardware can do to the compiler in an efficient way and have the compiler handle making that work. And as I said, this is closer to what modern instruction sets look like, but this assumption here that we can just recompile all the time hasn't worked out, so maybe not so much, because processors are still doing a lot of sort of optimizations that the compiler doesn't see, which we'll talk about later in the semester. But the RISC instruction set philosophy led to instruction sets which had fewer instructions. It had separate instructions to access memory. So in the RISC designs, instruction sets, typically you did not have instructions like add a value in memory to something else. That would not be something you'd implement. Instead, you'd have to do move the value to somewhere and then add it. That the add instruction would only, and the similar instructions would only take register operands, and that you'd have special dedicated instructions. You'd have move instructions to move values from memory to registers and vice versa. Otherwise, you'd work with registers. And this simplified things because this meant only a few instructions needed to be implemented to access memory. Also, RISC ISAs generally had fixed length instructions. They wanted to make the hardware that was decoding instructions as simple as possible. And they figured we could have the compiler worry about making that. And they also thought probably slightly bigger executables aren't a problem, which is maybe mostly worked out. They also have more registers. If you're going to require people to move values from memory to registers all the time, the compilers to do that, then you should have more registers so they don't have to do it as much. So they decided to use more registers, and maybe some of the space for more registers came from space they weren't using to implement complex instructions. That's a good use of that space that the compiler can take advantage of. And all their instructions are simple to implement, so they don't have any instructions that like do a loop. If you want to do a loop, you'd use multiple instructions. They don't have any instructions that access memory twice. And they basically have instructions that are, you know, have few ways of expressing things. So they're not going to have, like x86 does, 8 different ways of accessing or specifying a memory address. They're going to have 1 or 2 to keep the hardware simpler, because the compiler will worry about figuring out how to express its memory address in the right way. Because we're not writing assembly by hand. So this is sort of the properties that RISC was choosing. So these properties which are focused on making it, you know, making the compiler do the work and exposing sort of simple fast, efficient hardware with lots of capabilities, which is why more registers to the compiler. Now, you might say, well, what's happened to RISC? If you look at our instruction set summary, this property is not true of x86, nor is this one, nor is this one. This one kind of is. This one, turns out there's some special instructions. And this one kind of is, and this one not really. So you might say, why am I talking about this RISC thing when x86 shows it clearly hasn't won? And ARM, you know, ARM might be closer, but it's still a little off. And well, we still have backwards compatibility to what's clearly not a RISC instruction set. But if you look at what instructions compilers generate, they're typically instructions that are basically a RISC-like subset of x86. That's most of what compilers try to use most of the time. And modern x86 processors, the common implementation technique is that they translate the complex instructions to micro instructions that are basically RISC-like instructions. So the real instructions in the hardware follow this design philosophy, even though that's not where we're writing quite a machine code. And also, when the compilers generate machine code they generate is much closer to the RISC instructions than it is to these old VAX instructions. Like, the compilers never don't have the machinery to, like, take advantage of fancy instructions like this. And so that's not something that generally processors are targeting for the most part. Some exceptions, but generally not. And I guess even though sort of RISC isn't the dominant sort of instruction set design, the reason I bring this up is that seeing RISC versus the CISC debate shows us probably sort of the biggest question in goals for making an instruction set. The CISC design is saying, my goal in making the instruction set is to make it easier for the people who are making the software. And it's going to be, I'm going to provide what the people who are writing assembly want, and my responsibility is, once I've provided what they want, I'm going to work to make it as efficient as possible. The RISC design is, I'm going to choose instructions that make it easy for me to make the hardware fast, and I'm going to have the software people worry about dealing with that. So this is sort of the general differences. So typically, the sort of RISC-type philosophy is that I'm going to design my instruction set with an implementation in mind that is going to be fast, and that's going to might make the instruction set a little weird. You compiler people have to deal with it. Whereas the CISC philosophy is, I'm going to make the instruction set that you compiler people want, and let me worry about making it fast. And those are very different design philosophies, and for the most part, we're kind of closer to the second philosophy, I would say, for modern processors. Because we can have compilers and other software handle paving over the sort of awkwardness that creates. Questions? RISC versus CISC? Okay, so next time we're going to talk about the Y86-64 instruction set that our textbook chooses, which is basically a RISC-like subset of x86. So today.